museum panoramas, on television screens, on sheets of graph paper torn out of school notebooks. The candle flickered one last time and went out. It was time to go to sleep. If you turned your back to the monument, you could see a small section of the high wall and the silhouettes of the sharp-pointed towers in the gap between the half-ruined houses. But as had been explained to Artyom, you couldn't turn around and look at them, and it was also forbidden to leave the doors with the steps unattended, because if something were to happen, you'd have to sound the alarm. But if you so much as peeked, that's it, you're done for, and the others suffer too. Consequently, Artyom stood still, although the desire to turn around kept eating at him. Meanwhile, he examined the monument, whose bottom had been overgrown with moss. The monument depicted a gloomy old man sitting in a capacious armchair and leaning on an elbow. Something dripped slowly and thickly from his pitted bronze pupils onto his chest, giving the impression that the monument was crying. It was unbearable to look at this for very long, so Artyom went around the statue and attentively looked at the doors. Everything was tranquil. There was complete silence, and there was just the slightest sound of the wind rambling between the picked-over carcasses of buildings. The detachment had departed some time ago, but had not taken Artyom along. They ordered him to stay and stand guard, and if anything happened, to go down into the station and give warning of what happened. Time passed slowly, and he measured it with steps, which he took around the bottom of the monument. 1, 2, 3. It happened when he got to 500. A clatter and growling broke out to his rear, behind his back, where he could not look. Something was nearby, and it could rush at Artyom at any moment. He froze, straining his ears, then dropped to the ground and pressed himself against the base of the statue, holding his weapon ready. Now it was close at hand, apparently on the other side of the monument. Artyom distinctly heard its husky animal breathing. Moving around the side of the statue's base, he gradually moved closer to the sound. He tried to stop his hands from shaking and to keep his sight on the place where the creature would appear. But the breathing and the sound of steps suddenly began to retreat. But when Artyom looked out from behind the statue to take advantage of the opportunity to fire a burst into the back of his unknown enemy, he immediately forgot about both his enemy and everything else. The star on the Kremlin Tower was clearly visible, even from here. The tower itself remained only a vague silhouette in the unsteady light of a partially cloud-covered moon. But the star stood out clearly against the sky, riveting the attention of any who looked at it for a completely understandable reason. It glittered. Not believing his eyes, he took out his field binoculars. The star burned a fierce, bright red color, illuminating several meters of the space around it. And when Artyom looked closer, he noticed that its fire was irregular. It was as if a tempest was confined inside the giant ruby. It brightened in fits and starts as if something inside was flowing, seething, flaring. The sight was of fantastic beauty, not possible in this world, but it was poorly visible from such a distance. He had to get closer. Shouldering his weapon, Artyom ran down the stairs, jumped over the cracked asphalt in the street, and stopped at the only corner from where he could see the whole Kremlin wall and the towers. A red star beamed from each one of them. Hardly catching his breath, Artyom again looked through the eyepieces. The stars flared with the same seething, irregular glow, and he wanted to look at them forever. Concentrating on the closest of them, Artyom still admired its fantastic flows, until he suddenly seemed to feel as if he could distinguish the shape of whatever was moving inside, under the crystal surface. To better make out the strange outlines, he had to get a little closer. Having forgotten about all dangers, he stopped in the middle of the open space and now kept his binoculars glued to his eyes, trying to understand what he had managed to see. The demon lords, he remembered at last. The marshals of an army of unclean spirits that had been summoned to defend the Soviet state. The country, and the whole world as well, had fallen to pieces, but the pentagrams on the Kremlin towers had remained untouched. The governors who had entered into a compact with the demons were long dead. And there was nobody left to free them. Nobody? What about him? I need to find the gates, he thought. I need to find a way in. Get up! You have to go soon! Daniel shook him. Artyom yawned and rubbed his eyes. He had just dreamed something incredibly interesting, but the dream had faded instantly, and he could not recall what he had seen. All of the lights had already been lit in the station, and he could hear the cleaning women sweeping the platform while merrily bantering. He put on his dark glasses and shuffled off to wash up, having tossed over his shoulder a not very clean towel his host had given him. The toilets were located at the same end as the bronze panel, and the line of people waiting to get in was not short. Having got in line, continuing to yawn, Artyom tried to recall at least some of the images from his dream. The line stopped moving forward for some reason, and the people in it started to murmur loudly. Attempting to understand what was the matter, Artyom looked around. All eyes were fixed on a bolted iron door. It was now open, and a tall man stood in the frame. Seeing him, Artyom too forgot why he was standing there. It was a stalker. He had imagined them to look exactly like this, both from his stepfather's stories and the rumors gleaned from itinerant merchants. The stalker wore a stained protective suit, scorched in places, and a long, heavy body armor vest. His shoulders were broad, a light machine gun was casually slung over the right one, while a gleaming, oily belt of ammunition hung like a baldric from the left. He wore rough, laced boots with the pant legs tucked into the top, and there was a large canvas rucksack on his back. The stalker took off his round Special Forces helmet, pulled off the rubber face piece of his gas mask, and stood there, flushed and wet, talking to the post commander about something. He was no longer young. Artyom saw gray stubble on his cheeks and chin and silvery strands in his short black hair. Yet the man radiated power and confidence. He was completely at ease and collected, as if even here, in a quiet and cheerful station, he was ready to meet danger at any moment and not let it catch him unawares. By now, only Artyom continued to unceremoniously examine the arrival. The people behind him in line first tried to urge him forward and then simply started to walk around him.
"Artyom, what's the delay? You'll be late if you don't watch out."
Daniel came up to him. Hearing his name, the stalker turned towards Artyom, looked at him intently, and suddenly took a broad step toward him.
"You from Bedienke?"
he asked in a deep, resonant voice. Artyom nodded silently and felt his knees start to shake.
"You the one looking for Melnik?"
the stalker continued. Artyom nodded once more.
"I'm Melnik. You have something for me?"
The stalker looked Artyom in the eye. Artyom hastily groped around his neck for the cord with the cylindrical case that it now felt odd to part with, as if with a talisman, and extended it to the stalker. The stalker pulled off his leather gloves, opened the cover and carefully shook something out of the capsule into his palm. It was a small scrap of paper. A note.
"Come with me. I couldn't make it yesterday, sorry. The call came when we were already on our way to the surface."
Having said a quick goodbye and thanks to Daniel, Artyom hurried after Melnik up the escalators that led to the passage to Arbatskaya.
"Is there any news from Hunter?"
he asked awkwardly, barely keeping up with the long striding stalker.
"Haven't heard a thing from him. I fear you'll have to ask your dark ones about him now,"
said Melnik, looking back over his shoulder at Artyom.
"On the other hand, you could say there's too much news from Fedyenche."
Artyom felt his heart start beating more forcefully.
"What news?"
he asked, trying to suppress his worry.
"Not much good," said the stalker dryly. "The Dark Ones went on the offensive again. There was a heavy battle a week ago. 5 people were killed, and it seems there are even more Dark Ones there now. People are starting to flee that station of yours. They can't stand the horror, they say. So Hunter was right when he told me something sinister was hidden there. He felt it."
"Who died, do you know?"
asked Artyom, frightened, trying to recollect who was supposed to stand duty that day, a week ago. What day was today? Was it Jenka? Andrei? Please don't let it be Jenka.
"I wouldn't know. It's not enough the undead are worming their way in there, but some kind of devilment is coming out of the tunnels around Prospekt Mir, too. People lose their memory, and several people died along the tracks."
"What's to be done?"
"There's a council meeting today. The Brahmin elders and generals will have their say, but I doubt they'll be able to help your station with anything. They barely defend police itself, and then only because nobody dares make a serious attempt on it."
They came out onto the Arbatskaya station.
Mercury lamps burned here too, and just as at Borovitskaya, the living quarters were located in bricked-in arches. Sentries stood next to several of them, and overall there was an uncommonly large number of soldiers here. The walls, painted white, were hung in places with army parade standards, with embroidered gold eagles that seemed almost untouched by time. There was activity all around. Long-robed Brahmins walked about while cleaning women washed the floor and scolded those who tried to pass over the still wet surface. There were quite a number of people here, too, from other stations. They could be identified by their dark glasses or by the way they folded their hands together to cover their squinting eyes. Only living and administrative quarters were located on the platform. The shopping arcades and food vendors were removed to the passages. Melnik led Artyom to the end of the platform where the office premises began, seated him on a marble bench lined with wood that had been burnished by contact with thousands of passengers, asked him to wait, and departed. Looking at the intricate stucco work under the ceiling, Artyom thought about how Polis had lived up to his expectations. Life here really was arranged in a completely different way. People weren't as cutthroat, exasperated, or browbeaten as at other stations. Knowledge, books, and culture seemed to play a thoroughly fundamental role. They had passed by at least 5 bookstalls in the passage between Borovitskaya and Arbatskaya. There were even playbills posted announcing the performance of a play by Shakespeare tomorrow night, and just as at Borovitskaya, he could hear music playing somewhere. The passage in both stations had been maintained in excellent condition. Although blotches and seepage were evident on the walls, all damage was immediately patched by repair teams who scurried about everywhere. Out of curiosity, Artyom glanced down the tunnel where he saw everything was in perfect order. It was dry, clean, and an electric light burned at intervals of 100 meters, as far as the eye could see. From time to time, handcars loaded with crates passed by, stopping to discharge the occasional passenger or take on a box of books that Polis sent out through the entire metro.
All of this might soon come to an end, thought Artyom suddenly. Verdienka can no longer withstand the pressure from these monsters. No wonder, he said to himself, recalling one night on watch when he had to repel an attack by the Dark Ones, and all of the nightmares that tormented him after that fight. Was it true that Fedienko was falling? That meant that he would no longer have a home. He wondered if his friends and stepfather had managed to flee. If so, there was a chance of meeting them one day in the metro. If Melnik told him that he had completed his mission and could do nothing more, then he promised himself he'd head back home. If his station was destined to act as a lone covering force in the path of the Dark Ones, and if his friends and relatives were slated to die defending the station, then he'd rather be with them instead of taking refuge in this paradise. He suddenly had the urge to return home, catch sight of the row of army tents, the tea factory, and chew the fat with Zhenka and tell him about his adventures. It was a sure thing he wouldn't believe half of it, if he was still alive.
Come on, Artyom, Melnik called. They want to talk to you.
He had managed to rid himself of his protective suit and was wearing a turtleneck, a black navy fore and aft cap with no insignia, and pants with pockets, the same as Hunter's. The stalker somehow reminded him of the Hunter, not by his appearance, of course, but by his behavior. He was just as collected and resilient and spoke in the same way, using short telegraphic sentences. The walls in the offices were lined with stained oak, and 2 large oil paintings hung there opposite each other. Artyom easily recognized the library on one of them, while the other depicted a tall building covered in white stone. The label under the picture read, General Staff, Russian Federation, Ministry of Defense. A large wooden table stood in the middle of the spacious room. About 10 men sat in chairs around the table studying Artyom. Half of them wore gray Brahmin robes, the other half military officer uniforms. As it turned out, the officers sat under the painting of the General Staff while the Brahmin sat under the library painting. A person of short stature, but of commanding bearing, sat solemnly at the head of the table. He wore austere glasses and had a large bald spot. He was dressed in a suit and tie but had no tattoo to designate membership in any caste.
"To business," he began without introducing himself. "Tell us everything you know, including the situation with the tunnels from your station to Prospect Mir."
Artyom proceeded to describe in detail the history of the Vedayenka battle against the Dark Ones, then about Hunter's mission, and finally about his trek to Polis. When he related the events in the tunnels between Alexeyevskaya, Ryshkaya, and Prospekt Mir, the soldiers and Brahmins started to whisper among themselves, some incredulous, others animated, while an officer who sat in the corner, diligently recording the narrative, occasionally asked him to repeat what he had said. When the discussions finally stopped, Artyom was allowed to continue his story, but his recital elicited little interest in his listeners until he got to Polyanka and its inhabitants.
"If you will,"
interrupted one of the officers indignantly. He was about 50 years old, of compact build, with slicked back hair, and he wore steel-framed glasses that cut into the meaty bridge of his nose.
"It is known without a doubt that Polyanka is uninhabited. The station was deserted a long time ago. It's true that dozens of people pass through the station every day, but nobody can live there. Gas erupts there from time to time, and there are signs everywhere warning of the danger. And well, of course, cats and paper waste are long since gone too. The platform is completely empty, completely. Cease your insinuations."
The other officers nodded in agreement, and Artyom fell silent, perplexed. When he stopped at Polyanka, the thought entered his mind for an instant that the tranquil conditions that prevailed at the station were unreal for the metro. But he was immediately distracted from such thinking by the inhabitants, who were more than real. The Brahmins, however, did not support the angry outburst. The oldest of them, a bald man with a long grey beard, regarded Artyom with interest, and exchanged some words with those sitting nearby in an unintelligible language.
"This gas, as you know, has hallucinogenic properties when mixed in certain proportions with air," said the Brahmin, sitting at the old man's right hand in a conciliatory manner.
"The point is, can we now believe any of the rest of his story?"
retorted the officer, frowning at Artyom.
"Thank you for your report," said the man in the suit, interrupting the discussion. "The council will discuss it and inform you of the result. You may go."
Artyom started to make his way to the exit. Was his entire conversation with the two hookah-smoking inhabitants of Polyanka really just an hallucination? But that would then mean the idea of his having been selected, of his being able to bend reality while fulfilling his destiny, was just a product of his imagination, an attempt at self-consolation. Now even the mysterious encounter in the tunnel between Borovitskaya and Polyanka no longer seemed a miracle to him. Gas? Gas? He sat on the bench next to the door and didn't even pay attention to the distant voices of the arguing council members. People went by, hand cars and rail motor cars drove through the station, and the minutes passed while he sat and thought. Did he actually have a mission, or did he make the whole thing up? What'll he do now? Where'll he go? Someone tapped him on the shoulder. It was the officer who made notes during his narrative.
"The members of the council state that police cannot assist your station in any way. They are grateful for your detailed report on the situation in the subway system. You are free to go."
That was it. Police can't help with anything. It was all for nothing. He had done everything he could, but it changed nothing. All that remained was to return to Vedayenka and stand shoulder to shoulder with the remaining defenders. Artyom heaved himself up from the bench and went off slowly with no particular destination in mind. When he had almost reached the passage to Borovitskaya, he heard a quiet cough behind him. Artyom turned and saw the Brahmin from the council, the same one who had sat at the old man's right hand.
"Wait a moment, young man. I believe you and I need to discuss something. Privately," added the Brahmin, smiling politely. "If the council is not in a position to do anything for you, then perhaps your obedient servant can be of more help."
He took Artyom by the elbow and led him away to one of the brick residences in the arches. There were no windows here and no electric lights. Only the flame of a small candle lit the faces of several people who had gathered in the room. Artyom was not able to get a good look at them, because the Brahmin who brought him quickly blew out the flame, and the room was plunged into darkness.
"Is it true about Polyanka?"
asked a woolly voice.
"Yes,
answered Artyom unwaveringly.
Do you know what we Brahmins call Polyanka? The station of destiny. Let the Kshatriyas think it's the gas that brings about the gloomy enchantment. We won't protest. We would not restore the sight of our most recent enemy. We believe that people encounter messengers of Providence at this station. Providence has nothing to say to most of them, so they simply pass through an empty, abandoned station. But those who have met someone at Polyanka should have a most attentive attitude towards such an encounter and remember what was said to them there for the rest of their lives. Do you remember?
I've forgotten,
lied Artyom, not particularly trusting these people who reminded him of the members of a sect.
Our elders are convinced that you have not come here by chance. You are not an ordinary person, and your special abilities, which have saved you several times along the way, can help us too. In exchange, we will extend a helping hand to you and your station. We are the guardians of knowledge, and that includes information that can save Vedienche.
What's Vedienche got to do with anything?
Burst Artyom.
You all talk only about Vedienche. It's as if you don't understand that I came here not just for the sake of my station, and not because of my own misfortune. All of you are in danger. First Vedienka will fall, then the whole line will follow, and then the entire metro will come to an end.
There was no response. The silence deepened. Only the cadenced breathing of those present could be heard. Artyom waited a bit longer, and then, unable to stay silent, asked,
What must I do?
Go up into the Great Stack Archives. Find that which is ours by right, and return it to us here. If you can find what we seek, we will give you the knowledge that will help destroy the threat. And may the great library burn, if I lie.
Chapter 13. The Great Library. Artyom went out into the station, looking from side to side with a mad look in his eye. He had just entered into one of the strangest agreements of his life. His employers refused to even explain what exactly he was supposed to find in the Stack Archives, promising to provide him with details later, after he had already gone up to the surface. And though it had occurred to him for a moment that they were talking about the book Daniel had told him about the night before, he didn't dare ask the Brahmins about it. Then, too, both of them had been pretty drunk yesterday when his hospitable host had told him this secret, so there was reason to doubt its truth. He would not be going to the surface alone. The Brahmins intended to outfit an entire detachment. Artyom was to go up with at least two stalkers and one person from the cast, to whom he was to immediately give what had been found should the expedition meet with success. That same person would show Artyom something that would help eliminate the threat hanging over Vedienche. Now, having emerged from the impenetrable gloom of the room onto the platform, the terms of the agreement seemed absurd to Artyom. As in the old fairy tale, he was required to go he knew not where, to fetch he knew not what, and in exchange he was promised he knew not what kind of miraculous salvation. But what else could he do? Return with empty hands? Is that what the hunter expected of him? When Artyom had asked his mysterious employers how he would find what they were looking for in the giant stacks of the library, he was told that he would understand everything in due course. He would hear. He didn't ask any more questions, fearful that the Brahmins would lose their confidence in his extraordinary abilities, in which he himself did not believe. Finally, he was strictly warned that the soldiers must not learn anything, else the government would no longer be in force. Artyom sat down on a bench in the center of the hall and started to think. This was an incredible chance to go out onto the surface, do what he had only done once before, and do it without fear of punishment or consequences. To go up on the surface, and not alone but with real stalkers, to carry out a secret mission for the Guardian caste. He hadn't even asked them why they so detested the word librarian. Melnik slumped down on the bench next to him.
Now he looked tired and overwrought.
"Why'd you say yes?" he asked without expression and looking in front of him.
"How'd you find out?"
asked Artyom, surprised. Less than a quarter of an hour had passed since his conversation with the Brahmins.
"I'd have to go with you," continued Melnik in a dull voice, ignoring the question. "I answer to Hunter for you now, whatever's happened to him. And there's no backing out on an agreement with the Brahmins. Nobody's done it yet, and above all, don't think about blabbing to the military."
He got up, shook his head, and added, "If you only knew what you're getting into."
"I'm going to sleep. We'll be getting up tonight."
"But aren't you in the military?" asked Artyom, catching up to him. "I heard them call you colonel."
"Yeah, I'm a colonel, just not in their chain of command,"
answered Melnik grudgingly, and left. Artyom spent the rest of the day learning about police, walking about aimlessly through the limitless space of stairs and passages, examining the majestic colonnades and marveling at how many people this underground city could accommodate. He studied the whole of the Metro News penny sheet, which was printed on brown wrapping paper, listened to vagrant musicians, leafed through books at stalls, played with puppies that were being offered for sale, listened to the latest gossip, and could not shake the feeling that he was being followed all this time and was under constant observation. Several times he even wheeled around suddenly, hoping to catch someone's attentive look, but it was no use. He was surrounded by a swarming crowd, and nobody paid any attention to him. Finding a hotel in one of the passages, he slept for several hours before appearing at 10 in the evening, as had been agreed at the gate of the exit into the city at Borovitskaya. Melnik was running late, but the sentries had been informed and offered Artyom a cup of tea while he waited. Interrupting himself for a minute to pour boiling water into an enameled cup, the elderly sentry continued his story.
"So, I was assigned to listen to the radio. Everyone hoped to catch a transmission from government bunkers beyond the Urals, but it was no use, because the first thing they hit was the strategic targets. That's how Ramenki got smeared, and all of the out-of-town summer residences with their basements 30 meters deep, how they got smeared, too. They might have even spared Ramenki. They didn't try too hard to hit the peaceful population. Nobody knew then that this war was to the very end. So maybe they might have spared Ramenki, but there was a command point right next to it. So they slammed it. And as far as civilian casualties were concerned, it was all, as they say, collateral damage. You should pardon the expression. But at that time, nobody believed that yet, so the brass had me sit and listen to the airwaves over next to Arbatskaya, in a bunker, and initially I heard a lot of strange stuff. Siberia was quiet, though other parts of the country were broadcasting. Submarines, strategic, nuclear, went on the air. They'd ask whether to strike or not. People didn't believe that Moscow no longer existed. Full captains were sobbing like kids over the radio. It's strange, you know, when salty naval officers who hadn't uttered a word in their entire lives are crying and asking for someone to check and see if their wives or daughters are among the survivors. Go look for them there, they'd say, and later they'd all react differently. There were those who said, "That's it, the hell with it, it's an eye for an eye," and they'd get in close to their shores and launch everything against the cities. Others, on the contrary, decided that since everything was already going to hell in a handbasket, there wasn't any sense in continuing to fight. Why kill more people? But that didn't have any effect. There were enough out there who wanted to avenge their families, and the boats answered for a long time. They could run underwater for half a year while on station. They found some of them, of course, but they couldn't find all of them. Well, that's an earful of history. To this day, when I think about it, I get the shakes. But that wasn't the point. I once picked up a tank crew that miraculously survived the strike. They were ferrying their tank from their unit or something. It was a new generation of armor technology that protected them from the radiation. So here were these three guys in this tank, and they light out at full speed from Moscow, headed east. They drove through some burning villages, picked up some broads, and went on, stopping to top off with some straw distillate and then getting back on the road.
when the fuel finally ran out, they were in some backwater where there wasn't anything left to bomb. The background radiation there too remained pretty high, of course, but still it was nothing like it was next to the cities. They laid out a camp, dug their tank in hull down, and ended up with a sort of fortification. They pitched tents nearby, eventually built mud huts, set up a manual generator for electricity, and lived for a fairly long time around that tank. For 2 years, I spoke to them almost every night and knew all of what was going on in their personal lives. Everything was quiet at first. They set up a farmstead, and two of them had kids that were almost normal. They had enough ammo. They saw some weird stuff there, and creatures were coming out of the forest, the likes of which the lieutenant we were talking to couldn't even describe properly. Then they went off the air. I spent another half year trying to raise them, but something happened out there. Maybe their generator or transmitter broke down, or maybe they ran out of ammo.
You were talking about Ramenki, recalled his partner, about how it got bombed, and I thought for as long as I've been serving here, nobody can tell me anything about the Kremlin. How is it that it remained whole? Why didn't it get hit? I mean, that's where you'd expect to find right proper bunkers.
Who told you it didn't get hit? Man, did it get hit,
the sentry assured him.
They just didn't want to demolish it because it's an architectural monument, and also because they were testing new weapons against it. So that's what we got. It would have been better if they'd wiped it off the earth from the beginning.
He spat and fell silent. Artyom sat quietly, trying not to distract the veteran from his reminiscences. It was rare that he was able to hear so many details of how everything had come about, but the elderly sentry remained quiet, lost in some private thought, and eventually Artyom seized the moment and decided to ask a question that had preoccupied him earlier, too. But there are subway systems in other cities, aren't there? At least, I heard they were. Is it true there's no people left anywhere? When you were a radio operator, didn't you hear any signals?
No, I didn't hear anything. But you're right. People in Petersburg, for example, should have been able to save themselves. Their subway stations are deeply embedded, some even deeper than what we've got here, and the setup was the same. I traveled there when I was young, I remember. On one line, they had no exits onto the tracks. Instead, they had these hefty iron portals. When the train arrived, the portal doors would open together with the doors of the train. I remember this quite surprised me at the time. I asked everyone, but nobody could properly explain why things were set up that way. One told me it was to prevent flooding. Another told me it saved a heap of money on finishing work. Later, I became friends with this one subway worker, and he told me that something had devoured half of one construction team, and that the same was going on with other teams. They were finding only the gnawed bones and the tools. Of course, the public was never told anything, but those iron doors were installed all along the line, just to be on the safe side. And that was, let me think back when. Anyway, what the radiation may have spawned there is hard to imagine.
The conversation broke off as Melnick and one other person, short and thick-set, with deeply set eyes, and a massive jaw overgrown by a short beard, came up to the gate. Both were already wearing their protective suits and had large haversacks slung on their backs. Melnick silently inspected Artyom, placed a large black bag next to Artyom's feet, and motioned towards the army tent. Artyom slipped inside and, opening the zipper on the bag, took out a black set of overalls like the ones Melnick and his partner wore, an unusual gas mask with a full-face window and two filters on the sides, high-laced boots, and most important, a new Kalashnikov assault rifle with a laser sight and folding metal stock. It was an exceptional weapon. The only thing Artyom had seen like it had been carried by the elite Hansa units who patrolled the line in rail motor cars. A long flashlight and round helmet with a fabric cover lay at the bottom of the bag. He hadn't had the time to finish dressing when the tent flap lifted and the Brahmin Daniel entered. In his hands he held an identical zippered stretch bag. They stared at each other in amazement. Artyom was the first to realize what was what.
You're going up? You're our chaperone? You're going to help us go look for I don't know what?
He asked jeeringly.
I know what it is, snarled Daniel, but I have no idea how you intend to look for it.
Neither do I, admitted Artyom. I was told it would be explained later, so here I am, waiting.
And I was told that a clairvoyant is being sent up to the surface, and that he's supposed to feel where to go.
I'm the clairvoyant? Snorted Artyom.
The elders believe that you have a gift, and that your destiny is special. Somewhere in the testament is a prophecy foretelling the appearance of a youth led by fate, who will find the hidden secrets of the great library. He will find that which our caste has attempted to find for this past decade without success. The elders are convinced that this person is you.
Is it that book you told me about?
Asked Artyom. For a long time, Daniel didn't answer. Then he nodded his head.
You're supposed to feel it. It's not hidden from everyone. If you're really that same youth led by fate, then you won't even have to run around the Stack archives. The book will find you,
he said, running his eyes over Artyom searchingly, and then added,
What did you ask from them in exchange?
There was no use keeping back the truth. Artyom was only unpleasantly surprised that Daniel, who was supposed to give him information capable of saving Vedienka from the ghoul invasion, knew nothing of this danger, or of the conditions of his agreement with the council members. He briefly summarized the agreement for Daniel, and explained the catastrophe he was trying to prevent. Daniel attentively heard him out, and was still standing motionless and thinking about something, when Artyom left the tent. Melnik and the bearded stalker were already waiting in full combat dress, holding their gas masks and helmets in their hands. His partner now carried the light machine gun, while Melnik clasped a copy of the assault rifle that Artyom had been given. A night vision device was hanging around his neck. When Daniel stepped out of the tent, he and Artyom looked at each other with a swagger. Then Daniel gave a wink, and both started to laugh. They both now looked like real stalkers.
We lucked out. Before rookies go on important missions, they spend 2 years training under stalkers, fetching firewood from the surface. But you and I, we're sitting pretty, said Daniel, whispering to Artyom.
Melnik looked at them disapprovingly but said nothing. He motioned for them to follow. They came up to the passage arch and, after going up the stairs, stopped at the next cement block wall, where there was an armored door guarded by a reinforced sentry detail. The stalker greeted the sentries and gave the sign to open the door. One of the soldiers got up from his seat, went to the door and pulled at the bolt heavily. The thick steel door moved smoothly to the side. Melnik let the other three pass, saluted the sentries, and went out last. A short buffer zone about 3 meters in length began beyond the door between the wall and the pressure doors. Another two heavily armed soldiers and an officer stood watch there. Before giving the order to raise the iron barrier, Melnik decided to brief the rookies.
Listen up. No talking en route. Either of you ever been on the surface? Never mind. Give me the map,
he said to the officer.
Until we get to the vestibule, walk in my footsteps and don't wander. Don't look around. Don't talk. When we leave the vestibule, don't even think about going through the turnstiles or you'll lose your legs. Keep following me. I don't want to see any independent activity. Then I'll go outside. 10 over there, he pointed at the bearded stalker, will stay behind and cover the station vestibule. If everything is clear, then as soon as we're on the street, we'll immediately turn left. It's not too dark right now, so don't use your flashlights out there. We don't want to attract attention. Did you get the word about the Kremlin? It'll be on the right, but one tower can be seen above the buildings as soon as you come out of the metro. Don't look at the Kremlin, no matter what. I'll personally smack anyone who does upside the head.
So it's true about the Kremlin, and about the stalker's rule not to look at it no matter what, thought Artyom in amazement. Suddenly something stirred within him, some fragmented thoughts and images. Stirred and then calmed down.
We're going to the library. We'll go as far as the doors and steps. I'll go in first. If the stairs are clear, 10 will keep his sights on him and we'll go up. Then we'll cover 10 and he'll come up. No talking on the stairs. If you spot danger, signal with your flashlight. Don't shoot unless it's absolutely necessary. Shots can attract them.
Who? Artyom could not stay quiet.
What do you mean, who? Repeated Melnik. Who would you expect to meet in the library? Librarians, of course.
Daniel swallowed hard and paled. Artyom looked at him, then at Melnik, and decided this was no time to pretend he was a know-it-all.
And who's that?
Melnik raised his eyebrows in surprise. His bearded partner put a hand over his eyes. Daniel looked at the floor. For a long time, the stalker looked at Artyom with eyebrows raised, and when he finally understood that Artyom wasn't joking, he coolly answered,
You'll see for yourself. The main thing to remember is this. You can keep them from attacking if you look them straight in the eyes. Straight in the eyes, got it? Don't let them get behind you, that's all. Move out!
He put on his gas mask, then his helmet, and gave the sentries the thumbs up. The officer took a step to the master switch and opened the pressure doors. The steel barrier crawled upward slowly. The show had begun. Melnik waved his hand, indicating it was okay to come out. Artyom pushed the transparent door, raised his rifle, and jumped out into the street. And although the stalker had demanded that he follow in his footsteps and not wander, it wasn't possible to obey. The sky had changed completely since that time when Artyom had seen it as a boy. Instead of a limitless, transparent sky-blue space, dense gray clouds now hung low overhead, and the first drops of an autumn rain had begun to ooze from this cotton-like sky. A cold wind blew in gusts, and Artyom felt it even through the cloth of his protective suit. There was a mind-boggling, inconceivable amount of space here, to the right and to the left and in front. This boundless space was both spellbinding and strangely depressing at the same time. For a fraction of a second, Artyom wanted to return to the Borovitskaya vestibule underground and feel protected by the nearby walls and immerse himself in the comfort of an enclosed, limited space. He was able to deal with this oppressive feeling only by forcibly distracting himself to study the nearest buildings. The sun had already set, and the city was gradually descending into a dingy twilight. The skeletons of low apartment houses, dilapidated and pitted by decades of acid rainstorms, stared at the travelers with empty orbits of broken windows. The city. It was a dismal yet magnificent sight. Hearing no calls, Artyom stood still, looking about as if mesmerized. He could finally compare reality with his dreams, and with nearly equally blurry childhood memories. Daniel, who likely also had never been on the surface, froze next to him too. The last to emerge from the station vestibule was 10. The stalker slapped Artyom on the shoulder to get his attention, and pointed to the right, to where in the distance the silhouette of the cathedral's dome stood out against the sky.
Look at the cross, droned 10's voice through the gas mask's filters.
At first, Artyom noticed nothing in particular, and didn't actually see the cross. Only when a giant winged shadow took flight from the crossbar with a lingering, blood-curdling wail, did he understand what 10 had meant. After a few flaps of its wings, the monster had gained altitude and began to glide downward in wide circles, searching for prey.
That's where they nest, said 10 with a wave of the hand.
Staying close to the wall, they moved to the entrance of the library. Melnik led the group, staying several steps ahead, while 10 was stepping backward, half-turned, covering the rear. It was precisely because both stalkers were distracted that Artyom was able, even before they had drawn even with the statue of the old man sitting in the armchair, to cast a glance at the Kremlin. Artyom had not intended to do it, but when he saw the monument, it was as if he had been jolted, and something cleared up in his mind. A whole piece of yesterday's dream suddenly popped to the surface. But now it didn't seem to be only a dream, because the panorama and library colonnade that he had seen exactly resembled the view that was before him now. Did that mean that the Kremlin looked the same as he had imagined in his visions? Nobody was looking at Artyom, even Daniel wasn't nearby as he tarried behind with 10. It was now or never, said Artyom to himself. His mouth became dry, and blood began to pound in his temples. The star on the tower really did glitter.
Hey, Artyom! Artyom!
Someone shook his shoulder. A numb awareness came alive with difficulty. A bright flashlight beam assaulted his eyes. Artyom started to blink his eyes and shaded them with his hand. He was sitting on the ground with his back against the granite base of the monument. Daniel and Melnik were bending over him. Both were looking into his eyes with worry.
His pupils are constricted, stated Melnik. How'd you manage to lose him?
He asked Ten with annoyance. The latter stood at some distance and kept his eyes on the street.
Something made a noise back there, and I couldn't turn my back to it, explained the stalker. Who could guess he was so quick? Look, he almost made it to the manege within a minute, and he would have kept going. It's a good thing our Brahmin has a head on his shoulders, he said and slapped Daniel on the back.
It shines, said Artyom to Melnik in a weak voice. It shines, he said, looking at Daniel. It shines, okay, it shines, repeated Daniel reassuringly.
Weren't you told not to look over there, dumbass? Said Melnik to Artyom angrily, now convinced the danger had passed. You going to obey your superiors? He asked, and cuffed him on the back of his head.
The helmet reduced the educational value of the blow, and Artyom continued to sit on the ground, batting his eyes. Having finally run out of obscenities, the stalker grabbed him by the shoulders, shook him hard, and put him on his feet. Artyom gradually recovered himself. He grew ashamed that he was not able to resist temptation. He stood looking down at the toes of his boots, hesitating to look at Melnik. Luckily, Melnik didn't have time to read any sermons, as he had been distracted by Ten, who was standing in the intersection. He had signaled his partner to join him and was pressing his finger to a filter on his gas mask, indicating a need for silence. Artyom decided to stay out of trouble by now following Melnik everywhere and never to turn in the direction of the enigmatic towers. Approaching Ten, Melnik also froze in his tracks. The bearded man was pointing into the distance, away from the Kremlin, to where the long, crumbling high-rises along Kalinin Prospekt gave the appearance of grinning, rotten teeth. Carefully drawing near to them, Artyom looked out from behind the stalker's broad shoulders and immediately understood the situation. Right in the middle of the Prospekt, about 60 meters from them, he saw three human silhouettes standing motionless in the gathering dusk.
Human? At such a distance?
Artyom wouldn't have bet they were indeed people, but they were of medium height and stood on two legs. This was encouraging.
Who's that?
Artyom asked hoarsely, whispering, while trying to identify the distant figures through the fogged window of his gas mask. Were they people, or some spawn that he had heard spoken of? Melnik silently shook his head, making it known that he didn't know any more than Artyom. He shone the beam of his flashlight at the motionless beings and made three circular motions. Then he switched his flashlight off. In answer, a bright spot of light came on in the distance, moved in a circle three times, and went out. Tension eased immediately, and the electrified atmosphere returned to normal. Artyom sensed this even before Melnik gave the all clear.
Stalkers, explained the guide. Remember for next time, three circles with the flashlight is our recognition signal. If you get the same response, you can go forward without fear. You won't come to harm. If you get no response, or some other response, then run. Don't wait.
But if they have a flashlight, it means they're human and not some kind of monsters from the surface, objected Artyom.
I don't know what's worse, said Melnik, cutting off Artyom.
Without further explanation, he moved up the stairs to the library entrance. The heavy oak door, almost as tall as two people, gave slowly, almost unwillingly. The door's rusted hinges shrieked hysterically. Melnik slipped inside, put his night vision unit to his eyes while holding his rifle level with one arm. After a second, he signaled the others to follow. They could see a long corridor before them, with the twisted framework of iron coat racks along the sides. This was once a cloakroom. In the distance, in the fading day's light coming weakly in from the street, were the white marble steps of a wide rising staircase. The ceiling was about 15 meters high, and the wrought railing of the second floor gallery could be distinguished about halfway up the wall. There was a brittle silence in the hall, responding to their every step. The walls of the vestibule were covered by moss that stirred slightly, as if it were breathing, and strange vine-like plants, as thick as one's arm, hung from the ceiling almost to the floor. Their stalks shimmered with a greasy luster in the flashlight beams,
and were covered with large, malformed flowers that exuded a suffocating odor that made one's head spin. They also swayed ever so slightly, and Artyom didn't feel like venturing to find out if the wind blowing through the broken second-floor windows caused them to move, or whether they moved on their own.
"What's this?"
asked Artyom, addressing Ten and touching the vine with his hand.
"Greenery,"
came the filtered reply.
"House plants after being irradiated, that's what. Morning glories. Did a proper job of growing them, those botanists."
Following Melnik, they reached the stairs and started to ascend, keeping to the left wall while Ten covered them. The lead stalker did not take his eyes off the black square of the entrance to other rooms that could be seen ahead of them. The others ran their flashlight beams over the marble walls and the rusty moss-pitted ceiling. The wide marble stairs on which they stood led to the second floor of the vestibule. There was no ceiling above it, and thus both vestibule floors combined into a single huge space. The vestibule's second level formed three sides of a rectangle. In the center, there was a space through which the stairs ascended, and there were areas along the edges with wooden cabinets. Most of them had either burned or rotted, but some looked as if people had used them just the day before. There were hundreds of small drawers in each section.
"The card catalog," said Daniel quietly, looking around with reverence. "The future can be foretold using these drawers. The initiated know how. After a ritual, you blindly pick one of the cabinets, then randomly pull out a drawer and take any card. If the ritual is properly performed, then the name of the book will foretell your future, provide a warning, or predict success."
For a second, Artyom wanted to go up to the nearest cabinet and find out what section of the card catalog the fates had brought him to. But his attention was distracted by a giant cobweb which stretched several meters across a broken window in a far corner. A bird of considerable size was caught in thin filaments of apparently extraordinary strength. It was still alive, twitching weakly. To his relief, Artyom did not see whatever it was that had managed to spin this unnatural web. Besides them, there wasn't a soul in the vast vestibule. Melnik signaled them all to stop.
"Now listen," he said to Artyom. "Don't listen to what's outside. Try to hear the sounds from inside you in your head. The book is supposed to call you. The Brahmin elders think that it is most likely on one of the levels of the main stack archives. But the folio can be any place at all, in one of the reading rooms, in a forgotten library cart, in a hall, in one of the matrons' tables. So before we try to find a way into the archives, try to sense its voice here. Close your eyes. Relax."
Artyom squeezed his eyes shut and started to listen intently. In the complete darkness, the silence fell apart into dozens of tiny noises. The creaking of wooden shelves, the noise of drafts passing down corridors, vague murmurs, howls that carried from the street, and a noise like a geriatric cough that carried from the reading rooms. But Artyom was unable to hear anything that resembled a call or a voice. He stood like that, motionless for 5 minutes, and then five more, ineffectively holding his breath, which might have obstructed his efforts to differentiate the voice of the living book from the farrago of dead book sounds.
"No,"
he said, guiltily shaking his head and finally opening his eyes.
"There's nothing."
Melnik said nothing, nor did Daniel, but Artyom caught his disappointed look, which was self-explanatory.
"Maybe it's really not here. So we'll go to the stack archives, or more precisely, we'll try to get there."
After a minute, the stalker made up his mind and signaled the others to follow him. He stepped forward through the wide doorway where only one of the two original door panels remained on its hinges. It was charred along its edges and covered with strange characters. There was a small round room on the other side with a 6-meter-high ceiling and 4 entrances. Ten followed Melnik and Daniel, taking advantage of the fact that they could not see him, took a step to the nearest surviving cabinet, pulled out one of the drawers, and took a card out of it. Running his eyes over the card, his face took on a puzzled look, and he shoved the card into his breast pocket. Understanding that Artyom had seen everything, he pressed a finger to his lips in a conspiratorial manner and hurried after the stalkers. The walls of the round room were also covered with drawings and signs, and a sofa with broken springs and upholstered in cut-up imitation leather stood in a corner. In one of the four passages, an overturned bookstand lay near some spilled pamphlets.
"Don't touch anything,"
warned Melnick. Tenz sat down on the sofa, causing the springs to squeak. Daniel followed his example. Artyom, as if under a spell, stared hard at the scattered books on the floor.
"They're untouched," he mumbled. "We have to put out rat poison at our station's library, or the rats would eat everything." "So, what, there are no rats here?"
he asked, again recalling what Bourbon had said, about how the time to worry wasn't when a place was crawling with rats, but when there weren't any rats around at all.
"What rats? Are you kidding?"
Melnick made a discontented face.
"Where are you going to find rats around here? They ate them all a long time ago."
"Who?"
asked a puzzled Artyom.
"What do you mean, who? The librarians, of course," explained Ten.
"So are they animals or people?" asked Artyom.
"Not animals, that's for sure," said the stalker, shaking his head pensively, and said nothing else.
A massive wooden door located far down one of the passages gave a long creak. Both stalkers immediately darted in different directions, taking cover behind the embedded columns at both ends of the arch. Daniel slipped from the sofa to the floor and rolled to the side. Artyom followed his example.
"Up further is the main reading room," whispered the Brahmin to Artyom. "They show up there once in a while." "Cut the chatter," interrupted Melnick fiercely. "Don't you know librarians can't stand noise? For them, noise is like waving a red rag in front of a bull."
He swore and indicated the door to the reading room to Ten. Ten nodded. Staying close to the walls, they began to slowly move towards the huge oak door panels. Neither Artyom nor Daniel was less than a step behind. Melnick was the first to go in, leaning with his back against one of the door panels and raising his rifle so that the barrel pointed up. He took a deep breath, let it out, and then sharply pushed the panel open with his shoulder, simultaneously pointing the barrel at the opened black mouth of the main hall. They were all there in an instant. The hall was a room of incredible size, with a ceiling that disappeared 20 meters above the floor. Just as in the vestibule, heavy, thick vines with flowers hung from the ceiling. The walls of the hall were covered in the same unnatural morning glories. On each side of them, there were 6 giant windows where a part of the glazing remained unbroken. However, the illumination was very weak. Light from the moon barely penetrated a dense tangle of fat, gleaming stalks. Earlier, rows of tables had been arranged to the left and right to accommodate readers. Much of that furniture had been hauled off, and some had been burned or broken, but about 12 tables remained untouched. These stood closer to a decorated, cracked panel at the opposite wall, in whose exact center rose a sculpture that was indistinct in the semi-darkness. Plastic signs reading "Observe Silence" were screwed onto surfaces everywhere. The silence here was completely different from that of the vestibule. Here it was so thick you could almost touch it. It seemed to entirely fill this ancient, rough hall, and you felt afraid to disturb it. They stood there, searching the space in front of them with their flashlights, until Melnick concluded,
"Probably the wind."
But at that very instant, Artyom noticed a gray shadow that crossed in front of them between 2 broken tables, which disappeared into a black gap in the bookshelves. Melnick saw it too. Placing his night vision device to his eyes, he jerked his rifle up and, stepping carefully over the moss-overgrown floor, started to approach the mysterious access. Ten moved after him. Even though Artyom and Daniel had been motioned to remain where they were, they couldn't stand it and also followed the stalkers. Remaining at the entrance alone was too spooky. At the same time, Artyom could not resist looking around with delight at the hall, which retained vestiges of its former grandeur. This not only saved his own life, but everyone else's too. Galleries encircled the entire perimeter of the room at a height of several meters. These were rather narrow walkways enclosed by wooden railings. You could look through the windows from the galleries, and furthermore, there were doors leading to office spaces, both in the wall they were standing next to and in the walls on both sides of the ancient panel. The gallery was accessible via twin stairs that were located on both sides of the reading sculpture, or via an identical set of stairs that ascended from the entrance. And it was down these stairs that humped gray figures now descended, deliberately and silently. There were more than 12 of them.
creatures that did not quite melt into the gloom. They would have been about Artyom's height if they hadn't been bent over double so that their long forelegs, which amazingly resembled arms, all but touched the floor. The creatures moved on their hind